Velkommen til ny utgave av Inside Israel, her fra Internasjonal Kristen Ambassade i Jerusalem. I vårt forrige program så vi nærmere på den uetterrettelige påstanden om Israels ulovlige okkupasjon. Vi fortsetter i dag med samme tema, og du skal blant annet få høre professor i juss ved Harvard Law School, Alan Dershowitz. Men først, la oss oppsummere. Israels landområder har i historiens løp enten vært under jødisk suverenitet eller under skiftende riker og imperier. Det har faktisk aldri i historiens løp eksistert en palestinsk nasjon, suverenitet eller noe folkeslag. Før 1967 var det aldri tale om opprettelsen av en palestinsk stat. Historisk er det faktisk bare det jødiske folket som har gjort krav på Jerusalem som hovedstad. Før Første verdenskrig eksisterte ikke de grensene og statene vi i dag kjenner i Midtøsten og Nord-Afrika. Store deler av regionen var underlagt tyrkerne gjennom det ottomanske riket. Dette var tilfellet i 400 år for det som i dag er Israel. I kjølvannet av Første verdenskrig ble alle de forskjellige statene i regionen opprettet, både de arabiske og den jødiske. Under Sanremo-konferansen i april 1920, som var en del av fredsoppgjøret etter Første verdenskrig, ble Palestina-mandatet gitt til Storbritannia. Mandatet bygde på Balfour-deklarasjonen fra 1917, som støttet, citat, etableringen i Palestina av et nasjonalt hjem for det jødiske folket. Citat slutt. Årsaken til at man valgte dette området som et hjemland for dette folket, var de flere tusen år gamle jødiske røttene til denne regionen. I mars 1921 delte Storbritannia mandatområdet og ga 77% av det til hasjemittene. Det ble senere staten Jordan. Dette var helt klart i strid med mandatet. 24. juli 1922 ble Palestina-mandatet vedtatt av Folkeforbundet. Disse prosessene i det internasjonale samfunnet gjorde det til bindende internasjonal lov at dette området skulle bli et eget nasjonalhjem, dvs. Si en stat for det jødiske folket. Med andre ord ble det folkerettslig for den folkerettslige forankringen for Israels opprettelse lagt om lag to tiår før 2. verdenskrig. Så går vi fram til perioden etter 2. verdenskrig. I 1947 kom FNs delingsforslag. Her foreslo man å opprette en arabisk og en jødisk stat i resten av mandatområdet. Jødene godtok forslaget, som bare ville gi dem 10% av det opprinnelige arealet. Legg merke til at det var kun snakk om en ny arabisk stat, i tillegg til Jordan, Libanon, Syria, Irak osv. Ingen talte på den tid om en palestinsk stat. I motsetning til jødene forkastet araberne dette forslaget, og det fikk derfor aldri noen juridisk eller bindende funksjon. 14. mai 1948 erklærte jødene staten Israel for opprettet. Her rakte man hånden ut til arabiske naboene med ønske om fredelig sameksistens. Araberstatene svarte med å angripe den lille, gjenfødte staten. I krigen mot Israel okkuperte Jordan Judea og Samaria, kalt Vestbredden, og Egypt okkuperte Gaza. Så gikk det 19 år fram til seksdagerskrigen i juni 1967. I denne selvforsvarskrigen fikk Israel kontroll over Judea og Samaria, Golanhøydene, Gaza og hele Sinai-halvøya. Israel ga fra seg mer enn 90% av dette området, nemlig hele Sinai, gjennom Camp David-avtalen med Egypt. Nå skal du få møte professor i juss ved Harvard Law School, Alan Dershowitz, da han talte på Oslo Symposium 2011. Han er en internasjonal kapasitet når det gjelder Midtøsten.
Israel birth certificate is more legal Then the birth certificate of the United States, of Australia, of Canada, those countries started simply by colonialism and occupation. Israel was formed by law, by an enactment of the League of Nations, by an enactment of the United Nations, by legislative actions in the United States, Great Britain, France, recognition by the entire world, including, of course, Norway. So its birth is not in dispute. It is a legitimate country, and among the country, the nations of the world, has the same legitimacy as every other country in the world. So let's talk about 1967. What happened in 1967? We don't have to talk about the Gaza too much because the Gaza has, of course, been given back. What happened on the West Bank? Of course, Israel did not attack Jordan. Israel was not at war with Jordan. In fact, Israel sent a prominent Norwegian general to speak to King Hussein and to plead with King Hussein not to attack Israel. He made an incredible offer through the Israelis made an incredible offer through the Norwegian general. If you don't attack us, we will not take one inch of land from you. We will not take the Western Wall back, even though the Western Wall is the holiest place in Judaism, has been a Jewish iconic holy place since the destruction of the temple. We will not take that back. We will not take back the Jewish quarter, which has been in Jewish hands essentially since the days of Abraham. You walk through the Jewish quarter, many of you have done so, you see the signs all around you. You see the streets, you see the excavation showing the temple period, showing the Talmudic period. You walk a little further out, you see the Via Della Rosa, you see every step that Jesus took, you see the connections between Judaism and Christianity. It's so deep and so passionate and so compelling. But Israel said, we're not taking that back because no life is worth spending even on a holy object. Israel's position. What was King Hussein's position? He quoted it to the Norwegian general. He said, my answer will come in the battlefield. He fired 1,500 rockets into downtown Jerusalem at civilians. The Israelis had no option but to respond. They did. They captured the West Bank. That was in June of 1967. You wouldn't know this if you went to a university in Norway today. But what happened in July of 1967? What happened is the Israeli government, through Moshe Dayan, made an offer to the Palestinians. The offer was, we will give you back every inch of land captured if you just make peace with us. Just give us peace and you get your land back. Peace for land, land for peace. The Arabs all went to Khartoum to have a conference. They issued their three famous no's. No peace, no recognition, no negotiation. At that point, what was Israel to do? Israel had to hold on to that land in an effort to try to negotiate peace. As Abba Ibn said in response to the Khartoum declaration, is that the first time in history that the winners in a defensive war have sued for peace and the losers have demanded unconditional surrender. Or as he put it another time, the Palestinians don't know how to take yes for an answer. They were offered the land back. They said, no, no, no. The Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And this was one opportunity they missed in 1967. The opportunity didn't go away. The opportunity didn't go away. 1993, the Oslo Accords. This is the last time Oslo will ever serve, unfortunately, as a place of accord between Israel and the Arabs. There will never be another peace process in Oslo. Oslo has lost its role as a neutral arbiter between Israel and the Palestinians, unfortunately, because the Oslo Accords, I think, held enormous promise, and the Norwegian government and the Norwegian people should be very proud that it was selected as a place where Nobel Prizes could be won in Oslo, not only presented in Oslo, but won in Oslo, and several Nobel Prizes were won because of the Oslo Accords. A very, very proud and potentially constructive moment, but nothing really came of it. Why? Because building on the Oslo Accords, President Clinton and Ehud Barak offered the Palestinians everything they had ever dreamed for in 2000, 2001, 100% of the Gaza, 95 to 97% of the West Bank, and in exchange for the 3 to 5% land in other areas of the country to make up for it, to compensate for the fact that Israel had in fact built neighborhoods that could not be torn down in Maale Adumim and Gilo and other areas right outside of Jerusalem. They offered a divided Jerusalem. You know how painful that was? It's like cutting out your own heart. Jerusalem, the heart and soul of the Jewish people. I grew up as an Orthodox Jew. 3 times a day I prayed to return to Jerusalem. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget Jerusalem, may my tongue cleave to my mouth. May my right hand lose its cunning. The two things Jews pray for more than anything else is Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, and Shalom, peace. That's all you hear. You go to a synagogue, every word, if you only know 2 words in Hebrew, Yerushalayim and Shalom, you can sit in a synagogue on a Friday night, a Saturday, a Jewish holiday, and you will hear over and over again, Shalom, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, Shalom. And yet Israel was prepared, in the interests of Shalom, peace, to give up parts of its heritage in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. And yet the Palestinians turned it down. The Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, shook his finger at Arafat and said to him, if you turn down this offer, you are committing a crime against the Palestinian people. And Yasser Arafat committed that crime against the Palestinian people. Then he compounded it because he went back to his bunker and called for an intifada. And the intifada resulted in 5,000 unnecessary deaths. 1,000 Israelis were killed, babies, children, people going to pizza parlors, adults, emigres from Russia who were dancing in the Dolphinarium on a weekend night, blown to pieces, and 4,000 Palestinians were killed. It was a terrible, terrible tragedy. The blood of those victims are on the hands of Yasser Arafat and on the hands of those who turned down the peace offer in 2001. And then it was repeated. Ehud Olmert offered in 2007 and 2008 virtually the same thing, and the Palestinians again walked away. Why do the Palestinians walk away from these deals? I can give you an answer in one word. Norway. Norway is the reason the Palestinians walk away from deals that require them to compromise. Why? Because Norway has told the Palestinians very simply, you don't have to compromise. You don't have to do anything. We will recognize the PLO. We will give you ambassadorial status. We'll recognize your state. We'll give you everything you want. You don't have to give Israel anything. You don't have to negotiate. We will give you what you want without you doing anything in return. Norway, that's the problem. The problem is governments who are prepared to tell the Palestinians, we will demand everything of Israel. We'll boycott them if they don't do what we want. But of you, the Palestinians, we demand nothing. You just sit still. We'll give you what you want, as if you're the only country ever occupied. What's the difference between the occupation of the West Bank and the occupation of China, the occupation of Tibet by China, the occupation of Chechnya? There are several differences. One, the Palestinians have gotten attention through terrorism. The Chechens and the Tibetans, for the most part, have not. Two, the Palestinians have allies who have oil, and their enemy is Israel. Their perceived enemy is Israel. And the other third difference is Israel has offered to end the occupation. None of these other countries have. Has China ever made an offer to Tibet? Has Russia ever made an offer to Chechnya? No. The Palestinians are sitting on an offer right now. Just this week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said to the Palestinians on a CNN interview with Piers Morgan, come to Jerusalem. Invite me to Ramallah unconditionally. Let's negotiate. You will get the land. You will get 90-something percent, and we will give you the others in return. We'll have to negotiate hard about Jerusalem. We'll have to negotiate hard about some rights of return or refugee status. But at the borders, we can figure them out. Come and negotiate. And the Palestinians won't sit down to negotiate to get their land. Who ever heard of that? I'm a lawyer. I negotiate all the time. And when I negotiate, I don't say I'm refusing to sit down. When I want a position, when I want something, when you want something, you sit down and negotiate. You don't impose preconditions for negotiation. So is Israel in compliance or out of compliance with Resolution 242 of the UN? You read that, you hear about that, all the questions I was asked at the universities, 242, 242. I know a little bit about Resolution 242. I was there when it was drafted. I was Arthur Goldberg's law clerk when he was on the Supreme Court. He called me to the Waldorf Astoria during the negotiations for 242 and asked me to help him with the draftsmanship and the wording. I know what happened. I know the debates that occurred. And the end result of the 242 debate was that Britain and the United States insisted that the word territories be put in 242, not the territories, not all the territories. In other words, they adopted essentially what was then called the Alone Plan. Israel would be permitted to make small territorial changes to avoid what had been called the Auschwitz borders, the borders that would assure the death of Jews, and that would be part of it. And this was the most important thing that people who talk about 242 without reading it don't understand. There are mutual obligations under 242. Israel is supposed to return territories captured, but only when the Arab states in the area recognize its right to live in peace. Without recognition and peace, there is no obligation to return one dunam of land. There are no unilateral obligations in 242. They are mutual obligations, and Israel has complied with every one of them. The minute Egypt extended a hand of peace, it returned every inch of land in the Sinai. Every inch. You want to know something? It tried to give back the Gaza Strip, but Sadat was too smart to take it. He said, we don't want the Gaza Strip. In fact, Jimmy Carter writes in one of his books that the deal almost fell apart because Israel was being too generous. It wanted to give back not only the Sinai, but the Gaza Strip. In any event, there was a little dispute about 1 acre of land right near Eilat on the Egyptian side of the border that Israel had built up and put in a beautiful hotel with gambling. And so the Israelis said, look, we put all the money into that. We should get that area. The Egyptians said, no, it's traditional Egyptian land. And what do you think they did? They didn't go to war. They didn't plant bombs in each other's buses. They said, let's have an international negotiation. They brought in 3 distinguished international negotiators. Those international negotiators resolved the case against Israel in favor of Egypt. What did Israel do? Did it say no? No, it said yes. It gave the land back. It did it peacefully.
Nå skal du få se en film fra organisasjonen thelandofisrael.com som ser på Judea og Samaria fra en annen vinkel.
Behold, days are coming. When I will return the captivity of my people Israel, and they will build cities, and they will settle, and they will plant vineyards and drink from their wine. I will place them on their land, and they will not be removed ever again.
Bagina, or shel yareach,
Zionism, our national movement of return, to return to our land, is all based on our history, on the Bible, on the area that our fathers walked. Living here in the Shomron, we are fulfilling the prophecy. We are living out the essence of Zionism.
I think the most inspiring thing is to look around you and you feel like you're a part of the Jewish story. Every piece of land, everywhere you walk, history comes alive.
Behind me is where the tabernacle stood for almost 400 years.
Breathing this air and standing on this land, you feel the connection, not only to your father and his father before him, but all the way back throughout Jewish history.
Shechem, Shiloh, Beit El, Jerusalem, Hebron, Beit Lechem, all of the activities in the Bible all occurred here in the Shomron and in Judea.
I live up on this top hill on the left house. And the most amazing story is that when we came to live and we started to dig and build the house, we found many ancient broken pieces of dishes of clay from the time that the people of Israel used to come 3 times a year to visit the tabernacle in Shiloh. We thought we are the first to be here, and suddenly we found out that 3,000 years ago, hundreds of thousands of Jews, our ancestors, were coming here 3 times a year, spreading all over those mountaintops and eating the sacrifice.
The beauty of the Shomron is unparalleled. The fusion of nature and urban, city and natural, comes together in ways almost unseen in all of Israel.
In the hills of Samaria, we are not only at this moment in time, but we're transcending it all together.
The authentic Jewish life has always been connected to agriculture, always connected to the land of Israel. And now, as the Jews are now settling these hills of Samaria, there are over 1,000 dunams of olive trees, of vineyards, that are now producing fruits for the first time in 2,000 years.
Making wine today, there's no difference making wine today than the same way that Noach made wine, or Avraham Avinu made wine, or Rashi made wine. We take natural grapes for wine. After fermentation, it turns into alcohol, and there is nothing new. We do the same thing here like we did thousands of years ago.
When looking at the terrain of Samaria, you'll see a ton of rocks and boulders. And then from these dry, barren rocks, trees, vegetation, flowers, beauty, all of the earth is now coming to life again.
As a non-Jew, the reason why it's so important for me to be here in the hills of Samaria is because so much of this land has a history behind it. So much of the biblical prophecy is fulfilled all around us, and it's just amazing to take part of it and to support the Jewish people in what we're doing here.
Samaria is home to over 80 cities and communities with more than 100 educational institutions, a world-class university in Ariel, boutique wineries, organic and conventional farms, a wide range of industries, and a cross-section of professionals that represent the best in Israel today.
We have a
in the Ariel University Center, we have 24 academic departments in 4 faculties. From secular to non-secular, for Arab students to Jewish students, the 12,000 students are coming from all the parts of Israel. Only 15%, 1/5, are coming from Samaria and Judea.
I'm the dean of the Faculty of Engineering, and I'm responsible to this monster. This machine is a free electron laser. This is the only machine in Israel, and the only one in the Middle East. And it produces high power, very high power, that can be utilized for homeland security applications. The mood here in the campus is very, very good. Students very, very like to study here. They like their teachers, and also they like the science.
The foundation of Judaism has always been education. In almost every community in the Shomron, there are institutions that are teaching boys, girls, men, women, academic, higher Torah education.
It's important for people to realize that our communities, the so-called Jewish settlements in the Samaria, represent all parts of Israeli society. Actually, the majority of the residents in the Shomron region are secular Israelis.
Everything about Samaria was special for us. We are non-religious people, yet we came because we wanted to change our place of living. We wanted a place that we can teach our children the Jewish heritage, to teach them about Israel, about the right place to live in.
That's a great part of Zionism, of our national unity, all being together here and settling the land of Israel.
Understanding the strategic importance of Samaria is key. Only 44 miles separate between the Jordan Valley and the Mediterranean Sea. Samaria is also a mountain ridge that reaches over 3,000 feet high and dominates Israel's coastal cities, where 70% of its population, 80% of Israel's industry, and all of its airfields and seaports are located. If Israel were to withdraw from Samaria, the country's width would be narrowed to a mere 9 miles, which all analysts say is indefensible borders. Samaria, where Jewish history meets Jewish destiny, where biblical prophecy meets reality, where the Jewish people became a nation again.
Internasjonale kristne ambassade i Jerusalem sier nei til et jødefritt Judea og Samaria. Takk for følget, og Gud velsigne deg.